I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. It's great to have you with us. We've got a lot to get through today, but let's start with something that might have gone under the radar, which is still affecting a lot of people. On Wednesday, the Trump administration finalized a new rule that would eliminate food stamp benefits for nearly 700,000 Americans. Over the past several years, congressional Republicans have sought to increase restrictions to the federal food stamp program known as SNAP. And we heard from you about your reaction to the new rule.
I think we should increase the tax on the top 1% instead of making the needy suffer. I also used to be a food stamp caseworker, so I've been on both sides of the desk.
I have never relied on food stamps. I think that it's okay for the government to help out a little bit for people that really need it. However, I wonder sometimes if the system is being abused to some degree.
Of course, the cuts to food stamps could never replace the tax cuts he gave to the top 1% and continued lack of income taxes paid by Amazon, Google, etc. When did poverty become so offensive?
Poverty is expensive. The president boasting the greatest economy ever and then cutting food stamps, it likens itself to reinforcing the front lines in the war on poverty.
About 40 million Americans are estimated to have relied on food stamps in 2018, and with similar cuts in the pipeline, millions of more are likely to lose benefits by the end of President Trump's first term. For more on this, I'm joined by Claire Brown, a staff writer for The New Food Economy. Welcome back to The Takeaway, Claire.
Thanks so much for having me.
So who's going to be affected by the most recent rule change if these go into effect?
This rule change applies to so-called able-bodied adults without dependents. So this is a group of people that the government has decided could have a job and for whatever reason doesn't. They will now be required to work or prove they're looking for work for 20 hours per week, which is a pretty steep requirement.
So just to be clear, if these folks aren't working and now they're going to be forced to work, but if they're not working because they can't find work, how does that work? it feels like a little difficult issue to get past.
Yeah, there's some interesting research on who actually falls into this category. And as best we know, it's basically people who are kind of in and out of work. So you'll have a job for 6 months and then you'll be out of work for a month or two and you'll go on SNAP. As part of the 1996 welfare reform, the Clinton administration added this requirement that you can only be on SNAP for 3 months out of every 3 years if you're unemployed. And so that is the rule that this is based off. Now, there's been a waiver system in place for a very long time that kind of effectively makes the rule non-existent in many areas with high unemployment.
And yeah, because if you can't find a job in those 3 months, then what do you do?
Right, exactly. And a lot of states have work training programs that you can participate in to meet the requirement, and some will allow you to volunteer, but you're right.
So what was the rationale for these cuts, from the perspective of President Trump and GOP Republican Party?
So on a press call yesterday, the rhetoric was very much about how SNAP is designed to bridge a gap between employment. And there were definitely some echoes of the welfare queen rhetoric that we heard back in the 1980s. There was a lot of talk about people getting used to the program and depending on it and staying on it for long term. Now, I should be clear, the data does not support that rhetoric, but that is what the administration is continuing to say.
So what does the data that you have say?
Again, it mostly shows that people are on for a few months between jobs and that it's a program that's designed to be flexible for that exact reason. And most people who are going to be subject to these new work requirements are in pretty deep poverty, according to the most recent analysis that we've gotten.
Let's talk a little bit about that. You mentioned welfare queen rhetoric, and that's a term, that's a really loaded term that came from welfare reform, quote unquote, under the Clinton administration in the 90s. Often when we talk about belt tightening around entitlements, Claire, it's often framed either overtly or covertly as something that only affects communities of color. But the demographic breakdown, as far as I understand, for SNAP recipients, 40% of SNAP recipients are white, a quarter are black, almost 11% are Hispanic, 2.4% are Asian, and 1% are Native American. So what does that tell us about the recipients? Are poor white voters going to be swayed by Trump's decision on this? Does this hurt that community?
I have no idea how people will vote, but there is increasing evidence that SNAP is moving more toward rural areas. So you're absolutely right. I think the stereotype that it's mostly communities of color in cities is very much alive and well. But for the past decade or two, the benefit recipients have been kind of moving outward. And I want to say in 2016 or 17, for the first time, there were more SNAP beneficiaries in rural areas than in urban areas.
Why food stamps? Why go after this particular entitlement? It just feels, and using entitlement because that's the political language that's used, but we don't go after the farm bill the way we do and the farm bill subsidies like this. So why this, Claire?
It's been a politically fraught program since day one. I think it's the closest thing we have as a country to a universal basic income. It's cash in people's pockets, which for whatever reason, I think causes it to come under the microscope more often. You know, entitlements like Medicare, it's seen as much more evil to go after that because SNAP is essentially just money. And I will say that's why it works. It's been shown that putting money in people's pockets to spend on groceries really does help lift people out of poverty, but it's also vulnerable because it's seen as a check.
A check that's supposed to be used for food, though.
Correct.
So the proposal for these cuts went through a public comment period where members of the public, and this is standard, were allowed to weigh in on these cuts. Claire, do we know what the public sentiment was on these cuts to food stamps?
We do. I think there were more than 140,000 public comments submitted for this particular rule.
So people did participate in the public comment period.
Oh, absolutely. And most were against it. And there's a lot of political interest, you know, in the inbox. We got lots and lots of congresspeople making statements. Again, I will say this is one of three changes to SNAP. There's actually a much bigger one rolling down the line. And so this issue is by far not being put to bed as this rule rolls out. The next one coming down the line will impact even more people. It's estimated to strip benefits from more than 3 million people, and it will also take away free school lunch from about 500,000 kids.
The free school lunch is something that's also been debated because there are kids around the country who can't afford to eat lunch right now.
Right. It's kind of indirect. It will essentially make them not automatically eligible, so families will have to go through a paperwork process to get that benefit.
Free school lunches could be affected. What else could be affected? More Americans?
More Americans, absolutely. And even under this rule, it's an estimated 688,000 people will lose benefits, but there will be an additional couple million people who will be newly subject to these work requirements, these 20 hours a week work requirements.
You looked into expanded work requirements in Wisconsin and how they actually have played out there. What did you find?
So Wisconsin expanded work requirements back in 2015, so they're a few years further along than the rest of the country. It's often seen as kind of a bellwether state, particularly in the past when it had a very Republican-controlled government. A lot of eligibility requirements were pushed through. And so what happened in Wisconsin was that Governor Scott Walker expanded work requirements, and then they basically didn't tell people on SNAP that this program was coming into existence. And so they contracted with an outside agency called, it used to be called ResCare, it's now called BrightSpring Health, that manages foster care. It manages a bunch of, you know, kind of government contracts. ResCare came in to manage this work requirement system. And I talked to some former caseworkers with ResCare, and they said, Wisconsin didn't even tell people that we were coming in. And so they were cold calling SNAP recipients and telling them that they're newly subject to work requirements, and people didn't believe them. One caseworker I talked to said that people thought he was a scammer because this is a private company calling you and telling you that they are now in charge of your food benefits.
That's interesting. So, again, we talk a lot about public-private partnerships here on the show. Is it that private companies are now starting to take over the administration of these food stamps and benefits?
These work training programs, yes. And ResCare actually costs taxpayers twice as much per participant as just paying out SNAP benefits. It also cost about twice as much what the government estimated. And so it's not a cheaper way of managing these programs. It's just, I don't think the state of Wisconsin had the capacity to manage work requirements in-house.
That's one of the things I was going to ask you about, because a big talking point when it comes to cutting SNAP benefits, it's that it's supposed to save money. Did that happen in Wisconsin?
Not as far as I could tell. ResCare, again, cost the taxpayers twice what SNAP benefits cost. And that's in addition to SNAP benefits, because you're doing this to stay in the program. And it only found jobs for about one third of participants. And that's kind of the best case scenario. That's assuming everyone who got a job kept their job. So there's not a whole lot of evidence that it's working. Former Governor Scott Walker vetoed a provision that would require more oversight for the program. So data on the success is a little bit scarce. But basically what happened is a fraction of the people who are subject to work requirements actually signed up for the program. So lots of people just automatically lost benefits. A lot of that was because of the problems with the rollout. And then of the people who enrolled in the program, many lost benefits because caseworkers with 40 cases would just submit the paperwork wrong. One of the big problems that people talked to me about was if you don't have transportation, you can ride on the bus for an hour and a half to submit the receipt that said you went to the library and did a job training course for 5 hours a week. And so this 20-hour requirement, there's this initial layer of administrative red tape where you're having to show up in person to show that you did this work that then sometimes get logged and sometimes doesn't. And so my understanding, based on talking to former caseworkers, was that it was actually quite cumbersome to keep up with the requirements.
President Trump tends to favor using executive orders to get a lot of his policy initiatives that struggle to make it through Congress achieved. That was what he did here. Does this mean that a future presidential administration could undo these requirements?
Yes, I think so. As we've seen, making a rule takes a really long time. This was actually first proposed the same day President Trump signed a farm bill, because it was seen as a consolation prize for House Republicans who actually tried to pass via Congress much stricter work requirements that failed because House Democrats and even some House Republicans did not get on board. And so this was kind of an executive solution to get at the same issue.
And we should also mention that, I mean, farmers have gotten lots of subsidies from American taxpayers. Why is that not considered something that has to be examined in the face of when we're talking about the broader food issues here in the United States?
I don't know. The Farm Bill is this really interesting piece of legislation that has always tied food aid to farm subsidies. And it's basically they tied them together to get urban voters to support the farm subsidies that generally pass as part of the bill. And so rural legislatures and urban legislatures have always had to work together to pass this bill. And so I think farm subsidies are less examined because they're a lot more invisible. But there was reporting from Bloomberg yesterday that showed six studies agreed that farm subsidies as part of the trade war actually overpaid soy growers this year. And so they got in government aid more than they ever would have made if they had just grown soybeans and sold them at the market rate in the absence of a trade war.
Claire Brown is a staff reporter at the New Food Economy. Claire, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.